Okay, well, we're Jerry and Mary White. I think we know all of you. And this is our first time through this session that we have created, though some of the material that we have we've shared in some other contexts. So there's even a place or two where I'm going to just see if you have been through things with us, and we'll alter some things. What we would like to do today is we would like to respond to you. And I'm going to use this mic so everybody can hear when we get into some questions. You don't have to, but I think that will be helpful, particularly for the recording, but also so everybody can hear. So at various points during the time, we're going to interact on the issue that we're going to be talking about here. Walter Cunningham was an astronaut during the Apollo program. And at age 70, he was being interviewed, and here's what he says. "Don't be one of these people who say, if I only had my life to live over, I would have done such and such." He says, live in such a way that you only have to live life once and that you're satisfied with it. And I think that's what we're talking about. We want to be people who see our life as being led by God. Now, the reason we've called this session Second Wind, it has to do with the idea of a second wind when you're a runner. Is anybody a marathon runner? Is anybody run? Okay, there you go. Do you know what a second wind is? Do you get it? You really do? Yeah, you do. I mean, it is something that if you're a runner particularly, it keeps you going, and it goes beyond what you thought you could. When I looked up some definitions, it says it's a phenomenon in distance running, such as marathon or road running, where an athlete who is too out of breath and tired to continue suddenly finds strength to press on at top performance with less exertion. Some people call it a runner's high. And there's a lot of debate as to what actually causes it. Some think it's psychological. Some think it's endorphins or a lactic acid. Some, you know, there are all kinds of theories about it. But we do know about it. And so the idea that we would like to work with you on today is the idea of a second wind in life. And we'll discuss that in a little bit more detail. To give you a broad scope of where we're going to talk about the idea of a second wind. Then we're going to talk about some issues that we face in our personal identity. We would then like to talk about, the latter part will be on marriage expectations, the differing expectations between a husband and a wife. If we have time, and it's totally up to you, we'll see how this goes, because we do want to interact on things, then we'll talk about some things called time bombs that come up in your life and your marriage. And it's not just marriage. It is actually life. So anyhow, that's a feel of where we're going to go, and we may feel we have that need, that we just are running out of energy. Last Tuesday, I was playing handball, and I played about an hour and 15 minutes of a very heavy match. I had not eaten breakfast. I had a little bar for lunch, and that was, you know, one of those little, it wasn't even a power bar, it was something like that. Hadn't drunk a lot of water. And by the time I finished my match, I was pretty exhausted. And then the guy says, well, let's play doubles for a while. And that's easier. And we went on for another hour, and I was just dragging. I mean, I had absolutely nothing left. I mean, I was in the court, and I hit a ball once in a while, but that was about it. So I'd actually run out. I got no second wind because I had nothing down there to get it from. You know, so, and I know that lesson, but I'm foolish and I just don't do what I ought to do many times. So, the other thing that happens is we feel guilty when we start running out of energy. and we start running out of steam, and we don't get the second win. And so one of the things I'd like to show you is just a little clip out of two clips out of Chariots of Fire. So let's go ahead and do that, Jody. This is familiar to you, but I think it's a good reminder. We actually have a second clip here.
Thank you.
What did you see and what did you hear in those two clips? Let's just bring in some, I won't use a mic right now. What did you hear and what did you see? Okay, that was the final one. If you don't run, you can't win. So you lost once, so what? What else? Get up when you fall and you keep going. Okay, what else? Okay. One loved to run, the other loved to win, and only felt winning was the only thing that was important. Okay? Were both men gifted? Okay. Do you think either one of them was really better than the other? For the moment, in a given day, in a given time. Anything else that you see coming out of that? Yeah. He would probably never have set the record had there not been someone else running in the race. I mean, you don't win a race. I mean, people do run against time, of course, but it's not quite as visual. Abram said something that he really did wrong. What was it? Yeah. He said, it's absolutely fundamental. You never look. You know, he took his eye off the goal, and he was very, very close in that race. So just keeping some of those things in mind, we have in Isaiah 40:31, but those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. Key verse to what we're doing. Now, if we talk about a second wind, what are we really talking about? Okay, in our context now, we're obviously not runners. I'm going to give you four possibilities of what a second wind could be for you. Now, I need to give in a disclaimer right here. We're not going to tell you 1, 2, 3, do this, this, and this. That's not possible for us to do. We can't even do it for ourselves. What we're going to do is try and bring some things to the surface for you and give you a tool or two to be able to pursue this on your own. It's like any kind of instruction, nobody can do it for you. And there isn't some magic thing that you're going to do. Maybe there will be a concept or two that will help you today. And that's what we're looking for. So we're looking for the Holy Spirit to speak to you. So let's ask for that now. Lord, speak to us by your Spirit, by your Word, and by our interaction with one another. We pray in Christ's name. Amen. Okay, one possibility is just an extra burst of energy. And what that requires is perseverance and endurance. And that requires conditioning and some training that takes place ahead. Perhaps you're just looking for another, that should be chance. I missed that and I forgot to correct a couple other things in this, and Mary will get after me for this, particularly one of them. You'll see it. Another chance in life. And so that has to do with recovery and renewal. All of us need another chance at some things. Another is just the issue of refocusing, which has to do with stress and pressure connections. And the last has to do with the concept of simply finishing well. And I haven't put it up on the screen, but the passage that I'd like you to think about, or Mary and I would like you to think about, is 1 Corinthians chapter 9. 1 Corinthians chapter 9. And if you have your Bible, you might want to just turn there. We could spend a lot of time expositing this particular passage, but for the moment, let's just read what it says. It says, you know, this, the previous part was to the weak, I became as the weak, and by all means, I make myself into whatever I need to so that I, by all means, might win some. Then it says, do you not know, common knowledge, that in a race, all runners run, but only one gets the prize. Run in such a way as to get the prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last, but we do it to get a crown that will not last, that will last forever. Therefore, I do not run like a man running aimlessly. I do not like a fight like a man beating the air. No, I beat my body, make it my slave, so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified for the prize. Just a few key phrases. In such a way. There is a manner of running through this life. And there are rules. With a race, there are rules. You have to start at the same time. You have to stay within your lane. You have to do all kinds of things. And every athletic sport is like that. The second thing that you will notice is that they train. There is a preparation. There's another thing that says you don't do it aimlessly and you're not beating the air. And the other factor is you can be disqualified. Period. You can be disqualified. And that applies inside the Christian life as well as anywhere else. Now we can get into some theology on that. Now we'd like to talk a little bit about our identity. Eric Liddell, as you know, this was in the 1924 Olympics. And you remember the incident that he refused to run on Sunday. And last October, no, a year ago October, Mary and I had an opportunity, and Mary's going to talk about that. I'll advance it. Tell me when you want it.
Year ago October, we were in China. And we had a chance to go by Eric Liddell's home. And just thinking of where he placed his identity, it wasn't in the past when he had been the world famous runner, but he placed his identity in the Lord alone. We had a chance to go by his home where he lived in China before he was captured and put into a concentration camp. And it was really interesting to think about what he gave his life to, what was his first focus, and how he used, you might say, his second wind in his life to use it for the Lord. Until eternity, we won't know what came from those short years that he had in China. We all have opportunities to test our own identities.
You want to point that one out first?
Go ahead.
Well, if you look carefully at that, is I have a Band-Aid across my forehead, and I have a scraped nose. Just the day before, I'd fallen flat on my face in the Forbidden City. And I was lucky to be even alive. I mean, I cracked my head so hard. So my image through the whole trip was with scratches on my forehead and a bruised nose and a black eye. Okay, go ahead on your identity thing. You tell me when you want the next slide done.
Actually, that little Band-Aid is a miracle because we were in the Hutong, which is, and if you've been in China and have seen these old, ancient areas of living, and they were little cities unto themselves. Well, Jerry fell in the street. Now, if you've been in China, you know that there is no cessation of traffic. It's bicycles and motor scooters and all of these buses and trucks. When he rolled into this street on his face, there was no traffic. So I felt just ending up with a Band-Aid on his forehead was a
small price. I was taking a picture looking over here and the sidewalk fell away. Oh, well.
But then my identity was questioned because here I was, a Caucasian woman riding in the back of this bicycle wearing a helmet. Now, the Chinese do not tend to wear helmets, maybe a few little children. But I felt conspicuous. Have you ever felt like that and your identity seems insecure at the moment? So, did you, you took a breath?
No, I breathe. I do that regularly.
Oh, I see. There, our identity does change and refocus over the years. Of course, we all know that the solidity of our identity must be in the Lord. But there are other things that affect it. And that can be our level of education, or maybe our marriage status, or what our children are up to. If we're aging, that can make a difference in our identity. And we're finding that out now, just really, who are we? There are other things that can, maybe your failures or your successes. We find that our identity can be defined by the wrong things when it's not deep in the Lord. It's always temporary, our identity, if we base it on our activities and or maybe our positions.
One of the things that you could think about Eric Liddell is what was his identity. So in the 1924 Olympics, he gave us all. Then he went off to China. And at age 43, he put into a Japanese concentration camp and died there prior to the end of the war. So the question is, what was his identity? Was it as an Olympic champion, or was it as a missionary martyr in a country where no one even knew of his fame as an Olympian? He had this quote, "God made me fast. When I run, I feel his strength." You remember that quote. Now, how did God make you? One of the issues of a second wind is to be running in the tracks God has given you, not in someone else's track. Now, most of us would initially choose to have a lifetime identity of maybe an Olympic gold medal winner. One of our friends, heads of one of the other Christian organizations, said they were on an airplane, and this fellow was going up and down the aisles, and he'd go and he'd kneel by one of the chairs and say, "Do you know who I am?" And they said, "No." And he said, "Well, I," and he named his name. We could have the name. "You know, I played for the Dallas Cowboys, and I was a championship guard." And he went on and gave his whole history. Then he'd go to the next aisle, says, "Do you know who I am?" And he did that the entire flight. And all of us know of aging athletes who had their identity in the past. Now let's talk about identity for just a few moments. In Ecclesiastes 2:11 it says, "Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done, what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun." And then back in 1:11, "There is no remembrance of men of old, and even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow." If you've never seen the movie About Schmidt with Jack Nicholson, if you want a little depressing experience, go right ahead and do it. And I won't say too much more than that. So let's talk about identity right now. Okay, men, how do men get their identity? What's that? Yeah, work. Yeah. What'd you, yeah, Stan?
It's my biceps.
Your biceps. I see. Okay, well, I've got stories about that. One arm wrestle? Well, you know, when I thought about this, we live with an illusion of some external person. For men, it's usually our work and what we do, our successes, the promotions, the money, etc., our toys, cars, skis, cabins, condos, or our abilities, particularly our athletic abilities. And I could say that for me for handball. You know, I want to keep playing. I just wish I were better so I could have a better identity at it, but nevertheless. And then, how do you advertise your identity? It's really interesting. It's the clothes you wear, both at work and off work. You know, which brand it is and how you look and how what kind of jeans and, you know, the whole business. The cars we drive, the home we live in, where we vacation, and what we talk about when we're just standing around. So, Mary, what about the women?
Well, I think one of the top ones is appearance. And nowadays, there is almost no area of our physical bodies that can't be changed by the cosmetic knife. And there's pressure there. Perhaps just the clothes that we wear and the attention we give to our physical appearance. I think family success is one issue. And you've all just gotten your Christmas letters and the expressions of how well the children are doing comes through pretty clearly. And sometimes if a family is in distress about their children, those Christmas letters can be very discouraging. Some women take their identity from their husband's position or work. And years ago, I don't know if it's still true, but when we were in the Air Force, there were women who would wear their husband's rank very strongly. And I found that, you know, I want to be very careful if we're, in many ways, we're still associated with the Air Force. And I never want to say my husband is General White or something. I'm Mary White. And to be careful in this regard, not to grasp onto his identity. And then sometimes we look at financial security, and that becomes very important to us. And I recognized that when we left the Air Force and went full-time with the Navigators. I had always thought we lived by faith, but then it was put to the test, going into a faith ministry. So these are different arenas where we can find a false identity.
Okay, what do you observe more? I mean, some of you have observed people, and you just know that it's a facade, and it's almost... What have you seen? Men or women?
Terry, I play golf with a lot of guys, and they're always so excited to show me the latest new driver they just got.
Yeah. I'd like to talk to you about that. I need a new driver. It won't help my golf game, but it'd be nice to have one anyhow. Okay, so the new driver, so they got it in there. Or what other things are identity?
Typically, it seems like people who are most... most feel like they have to be in charge, or most aggressive about being in charge.
Okay.
Tilt your head just slightly and you say, that person is incredibly insecure.
Okay.
And they cover them.
Okay. What else? I'd like to hear from some of the women what you observed with either your own tendency or other women as to what seems to gauge the identity. Is the home a big deal?
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, right. None of which I even care about.
But that's true.
And if you walk into my home office, and you'll know it real quick. Okay, so very good. Okay, the home. What else?
I have a friend who's really concerned, I can tell, about just the aging process, and she's not that old, but she doesn't look like she did when she was 18, and that's really hard for her.
Okay. So the appearance, you mean? Yeah. Yeah, we all like to be recognized as younger than we really are. Skip Gray used to say, you'll never be as old as you look. And I remember that comment.
What school does your kids go to?
Yeah.
What school your kids go to, what they end up doing. And, you know, we have a lot of friends whose kids are doing very poorly. I mean, really, whether it be drugs or whether it be a bad marriage, and it is such a great pain. And it's an embarrassment. There's a sense of shame. They don't even want to talk about it. They don't put it in the Christmas letter. Once in a while, I get it in a Christmas letter, but not very often. Well, we could go on. Now, the next thing has to do with what's called the internal person. Now, we could spend a lot of time on this, but that's what Dallas Willard is talking on, right? The internal person, the biblical internal man or woman, is one who knows who he or she is and why he or she are here. And see, the internal person is who you are in God's eyes, and the task is to see yourself as a valued son or daughter of God. Now, the question is, which identity is real, the external one or the internal one? Well, let me just say, they're both real because there is an external you. Now, a lot of those external things are not bad. It's not bad to have a nice house, a nice car, a good job, to enjoy your work, to look forward to it, to look well, to keep your house clean, all that things. There's nothing wrong with it unless you really believe it is your identity. That's where you get into trouble. And as Mary pointed out, the external is always temporary, and the internal is permanent. You were going to do the Jeremiah passage, honey.
Yeah, a couple of passages in Jeremiah, which I'm rereading right now, and it's so rich. From 1:5, before I formed you, I knew you. Before you were born, I set you apart. And then he goes on to speak specifically to Jeremiah that he's going to be a prophet. But it's the idea that God knows us and he has a destiny for each individual that was ever born into the world. And then in 31:3, where he says, I've loved you with an everlasting love. I've drawn you with loving kindness. The idea that nothing can separate us from God's destiny for us or from his love for us, and that's what gives us our true identity.
Now, what happens when you misplace your identity? A misplaced or confused identity. And quickly, the fact is, we lose connection with reality. All it takes is your health starting to fall apart, and you realize that. The second thing is we set ourselves up for depression. The third is that we deprive our children of a model. Our children see who we become later on. The fourth is that when our identity breaks, so do we. Now, the next slide is the most discouraging slide in this entire presentation. And that is to answer the question, what does God use to correct our identity? What do you think it is? Yeah. Two things. Suffering and brokenness. You can suffer and not be broken. We didn't bring it. We've got several books we're going to show you here that you can refer to. But one is called, it's out of print, so you have to get it off from Amazon.com. It's a NABPress book called Embracing Brokenness. One of the best that I've seen with Nelson. His name is Nelson, and so I urge you to get it. But the fact is that Mary and I both know that those things really have been important issues in our own lives. And when I think of this identity, and by the way, You know, until we went through some pretty deep suffering with our son's death and other issues that have gone on in our family, we started believing our own press clippings.
I didn't have any.
You did. You did. We could point out both of us. And the fact is, you're successful, things are going well, and all that. And all of a sudden, you say, it doesn't matter anymore. Now you've got a problem of rebuilding your identity, and that other identity that was out there in the press clipping still is there. And it's still real, but it's not what you depend upon. I love the statement from Ecclesiasticus, not Ecclesiastes. And if you listen carefully to the beginning of Chariots of Fire, it starts out, if you recall, with Eric Liddell's funeral. Do you remember that? And a quote is given there. It says, "Let us now praise famous men and our fathers that begat us. The Lord hath wrought great glory by them through his great power from the beginning, such as did bear rule in their kingdoms, men renowned for their power. All these were honored in their generations and were the glory of their times." How are we going to be looked back upon by our children and those who know us? One of the more difficult regional meetings that we had, or worldwide meetings, was over in London one time, just after Mike took the responsibility for Europe, when we're really wrestling through some issues. And I went out for a run along the Thames, and I came in this village we were in to a monument to World War I veterans. And I read it, and I was so impressed that I went back to the hotel, got something to write it down, and came back and wrote it, and here it is. "They whom this memorial commemorates were numbered among those who, at the call of king and country, left all that was dear to them, endured hardship, faced danger, and finally passed out of the sight of men by the path of duty and self-sacrifice, giving up their own lives that others might live in freedom. Let those that come after see to it that their names not be forgotten." Well, that's identity. So I've said we lose connection with reality. We talked about the suffering. Now we come to the issue of what we attempt to do to be in control. So Mary, I'm going to turn it to you.
We have thought of five areas where we want to have control in our lives. Certainly the spiritual area, the emotional area, physical area. Sometimes that...
And this is what we... Are you going to describe what we can control in these, or...
Yeah.
How are you going to...
Comes next.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, you're way ahead of me. All right. In the emotional area, we can control our attitudes. Talked to one of our daughters last night, and one of the children had a little emotional outburst. And so they're trying to help her learn to control this kind of behavior. Well, if you see it in a child, it's one thing. If you see it in someone 55, it's a totally different thing. We can control our attitudes and emotions. Spiritual, we have every opportunity to go deep with God, to control our walk with Him. In physical, we have the opportunity to some degree, but we also live in a polluted environment and we're susceptible, and those of you who flew here were probably bombarded with bacteria and germs of all sorts in the airplane as you came, trying to be helpful here. But we can control our health to some degree, and we can control our relationships. Those bonds that we make with people. Now, there are some things that we cannot control, and it's all the same areas except for the spiritual. We cannot control our emotions. At the time of our grief, somebody said to us, you don't choose your emotions, they choose you. Now, you can also choose how to express emotions, but sometimes you can't control what you're feeling. And the physical illness may strike us, or we might have an injury. We were mentioning last night Mike's assistant who fell and broke her knee. And she was Jerry's assistant for many years, and she's invaluable, and I'm sure you're noticing it, her absence over in the office. Sometimes we can't control our relationships because we can't control other people. They may choose to break relationships with us or to become a very difficult person in our friendship circle. And most often you don't control the family because of the personal choices that they make. Now, this is once your family has grown to a certain degree. So these are areas of control. All of us want control in our lives, but we have to release that to the Lord. When we're thinking about our lives and how we're going to approach these areas of development and understanding, we're going to refer back to Gordon MacDonald's questions for the different decades of your life.
How many heard Gordon MacDonald when he spoke here?
Maybe
a few of you, three or four.
A few of you.
He's given us permission to use this chart that we're handing out. It's being handed out right now, Marianne.
It's going out, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So just on your own, pick your own decade of life, or pick one you'd like to be in, and then look at those questions. Now, they go up through the 70s, and I doubt that anyone in here has, well, maybe.
Marv and Bud and you and me.
Well, then, see, you've learned it all, so you don't have any questions. Yeah, create your own.
Yeah. Okay, what do you want to do? You say you're going to have a couple of minutes to do something here.
They're just going to take a quick look at the questions for their own particular decade.
Okay.
See if those are relevant for you.
I'm going to wander around here a little bit now, and I just like some comments. You've read what's in the particular decade that you may have, and I'd like to just hear a little of what you think about those questions and which one is very key to you. Now, for the sake of the tape, I'm not putting all of these on there, but who would like to make a comment? I'd like to put it on this. Do they make sense to you? Okay. Mr. Sturman.
I'm in the 50s, and why is time moving so fast? It seems like I was able to accomplish so much more when I had four small children around than I do now. And like the years just zoom by. So.
Okay, good. Okay, another comment on one of the questions. John.
Yeah, I'm in the middle 60s, and the question comes up, when you think about transition and vocation, what is there yet to be accomplished in life? And when you're fulfilled and challenged and gratified in a lifetime and a career of contribution, okay, now what? Mm-hmm. Now, Lord, what would you have for me?
Good. Thank you. Other comments? Sam?
Closer to 70s, so
Okay.
Just the questions and backwards. Where can I keep growing? That's something that God's been helping me with. So, and the other one is actually another one. Am I ready to face death? And I stand in your shoes, I understand what you went through. And having lost my first wife, God gave me some insights on that.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I'm ready to go. What else did you want?
Yeah.
These two hit me really strong.
Good. In the 70s, one of the key ones that many of us either face or will face, and it also was in the 60s, does anyone know what I once was? So it's a big issue for men particularly. What other? Any other comments that someone... Yes, Stan? Here you go.
Does anybody care what I once was?
And the answer is probably no. And, you know, the fact is our children hardly even know what we did. They know very little. They know maybe the name, and they say, oh, yeah, Stan was a podiatrist, but what do you do at the office? I don't know. He goes and fiddles around with this, that, and the other thing. But they don't really know what you went through. Okay, now, here's what we would suggest you're doing with this particular outline is that you and your wife... maybe in some small group, take the questions that relate to you and discuss them. Maybe just between the two of you and add some. And by the way, the book by Gordon MacDonald is A Resilient Life. And we'll put this down here. I don't know whether they've got it in the bookstore or not. Okay, now let's go on for just a moment. And we'd like to get into the issue of the refocusing process. Now, I'm going to move through this pretty fast because I want to get to the differing expectations. But the refocusing process has several components. Stress, the issues of stress, issues of health, the issues of family stage, and the issue of schedule and activity. And so Mary is going to talk some about the stress issue. And shall I hand this out now?
No, we'll hand it out afterward. Do you know that there's a new publication out called Going Bonkers? It's a magazine, and it's trying to bring some relief of humor to the stress that everybody feels. Now, we haven't subscribed, but sometimes I think maybe it would be a good idea. Because do you ever feel like you're going bonkers with the stress in your life? Now, the psychologists will tell you that there are three levels of stress. If you don't have much stress, if it's a very low level, that can actually lead to depression. And you would see it in retirement homes and in people that really have not much at all to do. Then there is optimum stress, which they give the title of eustress, EU stress. And this is when things are in balance and it can bring a real challenge to your life, and it helps you with problem solving. It gives you creativity and progress and change, and it's a good thing when that stress is in balance. And then there's high stress, and that can lead to things like low self-esteem and depression as well, or irrational problem solving. And you've probably seen people like that who are so stressed that they seem to make poor decisions and choices in their lives. We can hand this out.
Yeah.
We won't take time with it.
Yeah.
This is Thomas Holmes out of the University of Washington. It was done in 1967, but if you look on the internet, it's what you'll find today. And it lists things that come into your life that bring stress. And it gives them a numerical evaluation. And if you count up the things in a one-year period in your life, if you count up the number of stressful things, and it reaches 300 points, your liable to illness or a breakdown or something like that. Now, don't take time to do your addition right now.
Yeah, that's why we hesitate handing all these out. I always like to give someone something to read in case you get bored.
An interesting follow-up study was done on this, on CEOs and high-level
military
officers. And it found they had like 900 points of stress a year, but they were still functioning beautifully. And it was because they had a focus in their life and an understanding of who they were and what their job or their purpose was in life. And I think we can apply that in the Christian realm as well. We can bear a lot more stress than Thomas Holmes thought we could just because of the power of the Spirit in our lives. We're not going to do much on the health issue. You have that from every source, from the Sunday paper.
We are going to do one thing. Let me do the bucket first. Okay?
Oh, you want to do the...
Yeah, very quickly.
Ask how many of...
Yeah, I want to know, some of you may remember this illustration that I have used in the past. How many have seen this illustration that I've given? Can I just see? We'll stand. Not too many. A couple of people have. Let me just review it very quickly. If you think of any part of your life as a bucket, you have the normal operating energy, you have a reserve level, and then you go down into reserves. It's kind of like the old Volkswagen. They had to slip the handle to the reserve tank. Most of you can't remember that. Unfortunately, many people have a bucket that looks like this. It is hardly any reserves that are left. And so by the time you dip down into the reserves, you have nothing left. You're just getting into sludge, okay? And we can get more copy of this if you wish. Now, the way that life really is, it is actually three buckets. It's the physical, the spiritual, and the emotional. And you run those buckets at different levels. They're never the same. Sometimes you're in reserve, sometimes you're in plenty. You may be a runner and having no quiet time. You're in physical shape, that's great, but your spiritual life is running off the fumes. And so forth. Now, there's something that's wrong with that chart. There's an alteration I need to make to the chart, and what is wrong? Yeah, right. These feed back and forth to one another. In other words, they are not independent. When you're down emotionally, you'll tend to go down physically. When you're down spiritually, it affects your emotion. Do you see what I mean? And, of course, in the bottom, you need to have God as the source of the whole thing to influence it. Now, I'm not going to do any more with that except to give you the concept. That's what I want. You need to think about those areas of your life. But then we come to the health issue, and Mary, you were going to mention a couple things there.
Right. I think just to slip over this quickly, we'd like to recommend a couple of books that we have been using more or less in our own attempt to remain healthy. One is called Younger Next Year. It's by Chris Crowley and Henry Lodge, written by a doctor, a physician, and a 70-year-old...
businessman.
Businessman. And it's excellent. It looks sort of weighty, but it's worth looking at. And I know your library would carry it if you don't want to purchase it.
It's available at Barnes & Noble and paperback now.
There's also a Younger Next Year for women, but I did not find it any more helpful than reading this one. The other is Power of 10, which has to do with exercise. And
weight, particularly. Yeah.
Particularly the use of weights and how that builds your stamina. It also says that people who, you know that illustration better than I, people who use weights and smoke.
Okay, well, they did a they did a study, and this is well-based with research, by the way. They did a, this fellow actually is a gerontologist, and they did a study in nursing homes of people who were sedentary, and they started putting them on weights, just doing weight exercises, small ones, whatever. Two things were discovered. One is they found that working with weights was the only thing that they discovered actually affects the mental capabilities in terms of exercise. One would have thought it to be aerobic, and that's not what they found. And so they found it was actually weights. The second thing they found is they took a non-smoker and who did not do weights and did not do any of these exercises, and then took a smoker who started doing these weight exercises and some of these things, that the mortality was worse for the non-smoker. In other words, even the smoker recovered back out of it. And they did that with people in their 60s, 70s, and 80s. And the issue that came up was in the area of muscle, if you don't use it, you lose it. And in there, they described that the muscle system rebuilds itself three times every year, like the skin of a snake and like your own skin. It's constantly going on. So after age 50, it naturally atrophies unless you actually do something to counter it. Now, one thing they point out in that book is you can't change disease, cancer, illness, but they said what health you have, the quality will be better if you do some of the things that they mention. And of course, the things they mention are the standard everywhere: exercise, diet, and discipline. I mean, there isn't much else in terms of that particular area. 1 Corinthians 6 would be a key thing. Now, continuing to talk about the mental and intellectual growth, you said you had a couple things on that, Mary.
Next weekend, I'm flying to Minneapolis to help my aunt celebrate her 100th birthday. I've visited her in August, and she got out the Scrabble board, and we played a couple of rounds of Scrabble. There were four people, and she had the second highest score. Now, she has kept herself mentally very sharp. A lot of it is Bible study and reading the Scripture. And physically, she is still doing well, although she fell last July and broke her hip. However, she was up and walking when I got there in August, and she had fallen when she was dragging in the garbage cans after they'd been emptied. So, you know, she is continuing to keep developing her mind, to keep learning, even at her age. And in this area of learning, I think that is so important for all of us, no matter what the age, something new, something stimulating. Jerry has just taken up the cello. Well, he's learning to play the cello. He takes it up when he goes to his lesson. But he has not. You finally found a teacher in early December, I think. And every day, without fail, he has not missed a day yet. I hear it.
It's pretty bad. And it just has to do with a challenge. I also have a grandchild that does. Now, nobody had known that up to this point, even the office. And it's not something I have tried because I just do it for me. And it's something, I'd rather play handball, but we said, let's do something different. Okay, so one other thing is just the issue of family schedule and activities. This causes the greatest conflict. Now, I wish we could spend a lot of time on this, but we'll give you some hints on this in a bit. Mary has picked up a famous saying that we decided should be famous. And you want to say it? I can put it up there.
What have I said? I mean, there are so many famous things.
Oh.
Well,
you got to coordinate this.
I thought this came later. But a friend of ours said this to us a while back. No is a complete sentence. And sometimes if you're living with a persuasive or persistent person, that's a helpful thing to know. No is a complete sentence.
And the fact is, we can't do it all. And here are four questions. I didn't put them up on the chart. Four questions need to be asked about activity schedules. What must we do? Okay, there are several things you must do. You've got to eat. You've got to go to work. You have your kids' activities or your grandchildren's activities. There's a series of things that you actually have to do. The second question is a harder one. What do we want to do? There's that, and Dallas was brought on that, the issue of desires. What do we actually want to do? Then a third question is, what do we do because others ask us to do it? Some of you are at this conference because someone asked you to come. It may not have been your first choice, but you did it. I had a call yesterday afternoon. Somebody asked me to do something in the middle of our vacation, and normally I would have said no. But because of who called me, I said yes. And so I do it because of them. And that's what friends and fellowship are for. And the last question, it says, what can we not do? Now, maybe that's not the right grammar, but you know what I'm talking about. In other words, what things could actually be cut out that are not necessary for you to do? So if you would take those and help those, that'd be great. Now, we're not spending time on the spiritual growth. You know them, to keep growing, keep engaged with the lost, keep discipling, keep an attitude of praise and thanksgiving and accountability. All of those are important issues. But that's a whole seminar. Okay, we'd like to talk in our last segment here is on differing marriage expectations. Okay, as you get married, in your early years of your marriage, things tend to go pretty well. You love one another. Things are going well. You're sort of on this honeymoon. And then all of a sudden, you start seeing that there are some differences. Now, as you move through life and the expectations begin to change, why is that? What has actually changed? Mary has a poem. You want this poem?
Well, we thought if we were running out of time, we could abbreviate this whole portion with this little poem by Ogden Nash. And it says, to keep your marriage brimming with love in the loving cup, when you're wrong, admit it. When you're right, shut up. But I see we have a little time.
We've still got a little bit of time. Okay. Now, what has changed over the period of time that's caused expectations to differ? What has changed?
Reality.
Reality has changed. Okay. What else?
Jobs.
Pardon me?
Jobs have
the job situation may have changed.
Children.
Children. That brought another element into it, didn't it? Yeah, just the physical cycles of various things, yeah. What else? The technology and the pace of life, okay? Okay, we could go on. Let me give you five that we identified, and I forgot to change this chart. What has changed? And Mary says, it's not us, it's we.
Okay. Have you ever said, us have changed?
We had a little discussion on it. Okay. Okay, we as individuals have become different people, right? I mean, you are not who you were at age 22. The second thing is our marriage has changed. We've had problems, we have difficulties, we have arguments. In some places there's unfaithfulness, so there may have been divorces. And your actual marriage relationship has undergone significant changes. The other thing is that our needs have changed. As you grow older, not just getting old, I'm just talking about changing, your needs have changed. Many, many women say, you know, I'm not the same person I was, and I have a different set of needs today. And so does the man, in one sense. Our desires change. As life goes on, you say, there are other things that I want to do, good and bad. And Dallas was talking somewhat about desires. The other thing that has changed is our circumstances. That was what you talked about, your job, the family. So everything starts changing. Now, we'd like for a moment to talk about expectations. In other words, what are the expectations for women and for men that start where you start getting some dissonance? So were you going to take it first? I forgot.
I think you were.
Okay, I was. Okay. We haven't got much time, but what are the expectations in marriage for men? What are some things that a man thinks about? Man's perspective. Okay. Sex is an issue?
No. He's...
Is that what he said? Is that not what he said in my head?
He said respect.
Respect. I heard sex.
Give it up, Terry.
Just a minute. Just a minute. In my pocket are some hearing aids. And I have not got them in.
We were all thinking it anyway.
Okay. All right, you guys. Okay. Respect. Okay. This is terrible. I got to say, we haven't done this before. Okay. What else?
Never again.
Men.
Admiration.
Okay. Admiration. Okay. Significance, okay.
Leadership.
Okay.
Recreational companionship.
Okay. Recreational together, can I just say together? Mary is going to learn how to play handball. I've determined that right now. Okay. Well, that's enough for right now, and that was most of what I had on my list. Now, one thing that isn't on there is the issue of identity. Most women do not understand how important the work identity is to a man. Whether we like it, whether we don't. Okay, so identity. Okay, Mary, you lead the discussion. I'll write it down. You just lead it on women.
Okay, ladies, what do we expect?
Love.
Okay, love. I heard that.
Security.
Security.
Companionship.
Conversation.
Okay.
Communication. What
was that? Communication.
Okay. Communication.
Respect.
Respect.
Okay.
Protection.
Sorry, Mary.
Protection.
Protection.
Okay. Okay. Since time's running out, why don't you just summarize some other things?
How about an understanding of our changing physical appearance? Yeah.
Unconditional love.
Okay.
How about emphasis on family? Okay, I think that...
Okay, so we had some differing expectations. Where were we going to bring in this? Did we pass up the illustration on Peb Jackson?
No, that's next.
That's next, okay. Now, I'm going to mention some things about what I call... suggestions. Oh, we just suggest a marriage getaway at Glen Eyrie. That's a great thing. We also suggest the Love and Respect Conference. What's in Egerith? Yeah, it is super. It is just excellent.
They have a book if you don't.
And they have a book also. But okay, now here are the conflict of expectations. The time component. We view time differently. And we had a perfect illustration that came up in the last 3 days. Two perfect illustrations.
I can only remember one.
Go ahead.
If I don't get hit. We received an email from a local friend. And they have a friend coming into town that they're going to give a little reception in their home. he's apparently well acquainted with government affairs and that kind of thing. Sounded a bit like a politician to me, but Jerry said, well, why don't we go? And I said, well, it's on February 14th. And he said, so? We're still working this one.
Now, my friend actually said, he gave second email, said, I know it's Valentine's Day, but go to lunch. Do something else, but come to my house anyhow. And I said, man speaking. The other thing was happened through a series of circumstances, a trip to South Africa looks like it's going to cancel for me in late February. So I have already got two major things I can do. I got a trip to D.C., and I've got another trip to Dayton that I think I could put in. I immediately start filling it in, and so Mary sends me this email that says,
why don't we take a short break during that time?
But I said, never thought of that.
It's an unfamiliar thought.
I think we're going to do the short break. Okay, so there is a conflict of time, of how we view time.
Valentine's.
What's that? Yes. That's it. Okay, the other is a calling component. That is, what has God called me and us to do? We may have some different callings. This has to do with gifting. The third is a ministry component. That is, how should I go about fulfilling that calling? The third has to do with what we call the fulfillment component. That is, when we are doing God's plan, you will feel fulfilled. And if you are just miserable doing what you're doing, there's something wrong. Something doesn't click together. And lastly, there is that sexual component. We all change. Now, our observation, both in our own marriage and the marriage of others, is that the two things that give the greatest level of conflict, there are really three. One is schedule. The other is sexual changes in various aspects of it. And the third is money. Those things cause incredible amount of conflict. So now, we come to the end. Okay, and this is, so what, and what now? First, get well in every area. Spiritual disciplines, we need to work on those. I think clarify your purpose and decide to grow deep with God and to take specific action to differing expectations. Now, that's pretty easy. Let me just go ahead. The so what, so now. Identifying the problem does not solve them. Okay, that's why I said I can't solve it for you today. But identifying it gives you an opportunity to do something about it. So here's what I suggest you do. First, say, what is my dissatisfaction level with the differences between us in our marriage? If it's there but not a big deal, you might say, we have just decided to live with that dissonance. And that's not altogether bad. We've got areas in our lives where we have decided to live with some differing expectations and just negotiate them as we walk through it. Now, if it is a very high level of dissatisfaction where it is causing you a significant amount of conflict, then you need to say, okay, now what do I and we need to change or adjust? And I would look at it in three categories. What do I need to change right now? There may be some things. And I'm not putting blame on husband, on wife, on man, woman, not anything. Just, and so usually those are relatively simple. The second thing is, what do I need to work on during the next half a year, 3 to 6 months, that we need to alter this, and what do we need to do in the next year and beyond? Then for each of you to ask yourself the question, what should I do? Now, you won't know that until you've had a conversation with one another. In other words, you have to have some interaction on this. Then it may come clear as to what I should do. Then the second question is, what should we do? Because you are together. So that's basically where we're going to leave it with you. Now we have did we show all the books? Oh, the Love and Respect book.
Yeah,
by Erickson. It's here. And so we encourage you to think about those things. And I hope this will give you some little foundation that you can go forward to getting a second wind or to refocusing your life. I warned you that there's no magic formula. But we wanted this to be some tools that you could use and some other things that you can do. Let's pray. Yes, ma'am. Do you have any? Oh, we have some other handouts. We're going to leave them over here. One's called The 8 Marital Challenges for the Second Half Marriage, A Marriage Builder, Reflecting on My Marriage, and then a little check sheet. And this comes from The Second Half of Marriage, Facing the 8 Challenges of Every Long-Term Marriage by David and Claudia Arp. They're very good. We just make them available to you. And then you can use them as you wish. So let's pray. Father, thank you for this time. Help us now to bring honor to your name by our lives, that we would learn to do what you've called us to do, not just to muddle through life doing what everybody else wants us to do, or to run through life frantically, not without focus, without calling. Help us to get a sense then of how to balance the dissonance in our own marriage, and help us to learn to appreciate one another with our individual gifting. So we commit this to you in Christ's name. Amen.